George Stevenson. One chill, foggy night, early in the year of 1813, an awkward, freckle-faced lad of 18 rapped at the humble door of a cottage in northern England and asked to see the schoolmaster. Face to face with him, he spoke up modestly, "I would like to join your evening school, sir." "Humph," said the master a trifle scornfully, taking more note of the ragged waistcoat, the short breeches, and bare, sturdy legs than he did of the honest, eager face. "What do you wish to study?" "I want to learn to read and write, sir," the youth replied. "Very well, you may come," returned the master ungraciously, "but I am bound to say that a great, bare-legged laddie like you would be better at work in the mines than learning his letters," and he closed the door in the lad's face. But the young man was not disheartened. He had no wish to spend his life in the mines. His father, Robert Stevenson, was a fireman at one of the Killingworth colliery pumping engines. Their home was a mere hovel with a clay floor, mud walls, and bare rafters. When he was 5 years old, the boy had begun to make his own living, first by herding cows, then at picking stones from the coal, and later by driving the horse which drew coal from the pit. There were many children in the Stevenson home. Times were hard, and always George had been half-fed and half-clothed. Now at 18, he was himself a fireman. He knew his engine thoroughly and could take it apart and make any ordinary repairs. He knew, too, that it was a long way from being a perfect engine. He had his own ideas for improving it, and he wanted to know what the world of engineering and mechanics had to say. So he cared not one whit for the testy, scornful old master. He plunged into the task set before him with a determination and energy which soon won the former's hearty respect, and he did all in his power to help him. During the night watches, between bites at lunch, and every spare moment he could find, the lad scrawled letters and figures with a bit of chalk on the sides of the coal wagons. In a short time, he could not only read very well, but write a fair hand and solve ordinary problems in arithmetic. Then he turned eagerly to the printed world of mechanics, hoarding his pennies to buy what he thought would help him. He made models of new engines in clay, and soon people began to speak of him as a skillful engineer, one of whom the world was destined to hear. In 1815, just a little over 100 years ago, he planned and built his first locomotive. It was a triumph for a youth of 20, but it did not satisfy its builder. It was not fast enough. He determined to make a better one and went on studying and planning, turning out model after model, each one better than its predecessor, but all of them crude enough compared with the engines we know today. By and by his employers put young Stevenson's locomotive on their road, but he was not yet satisfied and went on with his plans and models. Then, in 1821, came a reward for the young inventor's perseverance and a chance for greater opportunities. He was appointed chief engineer for the now historic Stockton and Darlington Railroad, and here he built and put into operation his own engines entirely. But though these were an improvement on any locomotives yet built, they did not supersede the work of horses. They moved slowly and burned so much coal that they could not compete with the horses in point of economy, for horses were still so used. Indeed, in those days, most people argued that horses were the only practical thing to use. No one but the crazy inventors had any faith in the locomotive ever becoming a motive power. It was customary to use engines only on the stiffest pulls, for the balance horses did the work. Few had yet thought of using the railways for passenger travel. They were built almost entirely for use in the mines and were only a few miles in length. All great inventions have small beginnings, and this is very strikingly true of the railroad. Indeed, the inventors of the first steam carriage had no idea of building a railroad track. They undertook to build an engine for use on common roads. Then somebody got a glimmering of turning to account the tramways, that is, the roads built for trams or wagons, such as were in use for transporting coal from mines. In this primitive railway, wooden rails were fastened lengthways on half-buried timbers for the purpose of keeping the cart wheels on the track. A little later, the carts or cars were wheeled along the rails themselves. Then, to prevent the wooden rails from wearing out, they were covered with iron, and at last the rails were wholly made of that material. At first, only stationary engines were used on the railroads, the horses being taken off at the heavy points, and the engines by means of ropes and chains doing duty instead. But there seemed no good reason why a locomotive could not be made to run along the track, provided the line ran fairly straight, for of course no locomotive could be built to take sharp curves. Even our friend George Stephenson, when he had become the foremost authority on locomotives, declared that steam could not be used as a motive power on a road having curves of less than 900 feet radius. Neither could a locomotive be expected to climb grades. It would be necessary to make a wide detour around the hills. In 1826, one of the longest railroads which had yet been built was proposed between Liverpool and Manchester. It was designed for both passenger and freight traffic, and George Stephenson, who was now engaged with his son Robert in the manufacture of locomotives at Newcastle-on-Tyne, was asked to become chief engineer. He accepted delightedly, and at once proposed to use locomotives entirely. His employers were dumbfounded, for Stephenson stood almost alone in advocating steam power exclusively. At length, however, the company, catching something of his enthusiasm, agreed at least to consider the matter, and by way of a beginning, offered a prize of £500 for the best locomotive that could be built by a certain day. Stephenson himself at once decided to enter the contest. When his friends learned that he proposed to make an engine that would go 12 miles an hour, everyone said this was absurd, that it could not be done. 12 miles an hour, said the critics, as well trust oneself to be fired off on a rocket. One man, who thought himself very wise, said to the inventor shrewdly, suppose you invent an engine of such speed, and suppose while it is running, a cow should stray upon the track. Would that not be a very awkward circumstance? I should think it might, for the cow, answered the engineer dryly. When the appointed day came, four competitors were in the contest, but Stephenson's locomotive carried off the prize at the unprecedented speed of 15 miles an hour. It was dubbed the Rocket, and marvelous indeed was its makeup, viewed both in the light of the present and the past. It was a four-wheel engine supported on springs, and with its tender water and coke weighed something over 4 tons. No cab sheltered the engineer, no brake checked the speed, and the tall smokestack belched smoke and red-hot cinders. But it effectively crashed through ignorance and prejudice and proved conclusively that steam was the only motive power for railways. By making a few changes, the Rocket gained an added speed of 14 miles per hour. Later, on being put to work in the coal fields, it demonstrated that it could go 60 miles an hour, and thus fully established its inventor in the foremost rank of the mechanical engineers of the 19th century. The myriad of locomotives of the present day are, in their working principles, identical with the locomotive built by this great engineer some 80 years ago. The cowcatcher, or pilot, placed in front to remove obstacles from the track, the bell and the whistle are American developments. So, too, is the sandbox from which sand is sprinkled on the rails to prevent the slipping of the driving wheels. It is of interest to note here that the first fatal railway accident is laid at the door of the Rocket. Mr. Huskisson, Home Secretary in the British Cabinet, was knocked down by the locomotive, the wheels passing over his legs. He was placed on board another engine, the Northumbrian, driven by George Stephenson himself, who speeded the locomotive 15 miles in 25 minutes at the rate of 35 miles an hour to Eccles, where the injured man died that night. As the model railway of its time, the track construction of the Liverpool and Manchester Railway also deserves some mention. It was surveyed and planned entirely by George Stephenson. Upon the graded surface was placed a layer of broken stone 2 feet deep. Stone blocks 2 feet square were set 3 feet apart, and upon them and upon the wooden cross ties used on embankments were fastened cast iron chairs in which the rails were secured by wedges. The rails were of wrought iron 15 feet long and were rolled with the web deeper at the middle than at the ends. These rails weighed 35 pounds per yard, an unheard of measure in those days, but a small affair compared with the huge rails that are used in the railroads of the present. Not only did Stephenson's work on the Liverpool and Manchester Railway prove the practicability of the locomotive for freight and passenger traffic, but it fired the world to build like commercial thoroughfares. In 10 years, Great Britain had over 1,000 miles of railroad. In our country, as yet, the locomotive was a rude affair. It could go no faster than 15 miles an hour. When a hill blocked the way, the road either went around it, or the train was let down or pulled up, as the case might be, by means of a rope and a stationary engine. The old Portage Railroad, built by the state of Pennsylvania, was the most pretentious, but it had no cars or motive power of any sort, excepting the stationary engines on the hilltops. Anybody might use the line who paid 2 cents per mile for each passenger, and $4.92 for each car sent over the rails. Imagine the fierce competition and the resulting confusion. Horses furnished most of the motive power. Here and there along the way were turnouts where drivers might pass, but these selfsame drivers were a pig-headed lot. They gave small heed to the turnouts, and when they met face to face, there was a fight and a block, and those in the rear might fret and fume as they pleased. Finally, the state built a double track to keep the peace, but then a new source of contention arose. Locomotives were now coming into more general use. These, of course, were faster than horses, and the driver with the horse would seldom take a siding for the locomotive. Stephenson's triumph gave American inventors just the aid and stimulus needed and ended the brawls. The state bought American-made locomotives and charged for hauling the cars. Such a crowd as one of these snorting, puffing little locomotives and its odd cars would draw could it pass along a main line today. Even one of the old-style steam-threshing engines, familiar to all country-bred boys and girls, would be a marvel in comparison. These first engines had no cab, no brake. They used wood for fuel and had a tall smokestack, which must be unjointed and laid down to pass through the covered bridges, while the passengers were showered with belching smoke and cinders and forced to cover their eyes, mouth, and nostrils. For a while, our first locomotives ran on strap rails, made of wooden beams or stringers laid on stone blocks and protected on the top surface, where the wheels of the car rested, by long strips or straps of iron spiked on. Often these spikes would work loose, and as the car passed over, the strap would curl up and come through the bottom of the car, making what was known in the railway parlance as a snake's head. With his reputation as an engineer established, Stephenson shortly became chief or consulting engineer to nearly all of the railway projects that were set on foot. He interested himself in motive power for coal mines, and wealth flowed upon him. In 1846, he visited the continent, where he was received with unusual honors. Wise men sought his friendship, tributes and medals were heaped upon him. He was the first president of the Institution of Mechanical Engineers, which he founded in 1847. His king offered him a knighthood, but he preferred to remain plain George Stephenson. His last years were spent in the pursuits of a quiet country life on his estate at Tapton House, Chesterfield, where he died August 12, 1848. What magical changes have resulted from the genius and the labors of this man. The locomotive has changed the character of human life. It has made the globe smaller for us, and our knowledge of its countries and peoples and products vastly greater. Surely the man who perfected it, George Stevenson deserves to be called one of the benefactors of mankind.